Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, a look into the murky underworld of the global arms trade and its costs to society, democracy, and security. Finally, on the Scholar Circle, we look at the reality with regards to poverty, inequality, and social mobility, both here in the U.S. and worldwide. The global arms trade is a murky world where the legal transactions meet the black and gray markets, according to our next guest. It's a world of corruption, deceit, and death that is largely conducted underground, he says. And it accounts for more than $1.5 trillion of spending worldwide, amounting to roughly $235 per person on the planet. There are also hidden costs to the arms trade, costs to democracy, to society, and ironically, to national security, he says. Andrew Feinstein is a former member of parliament in South Africa, a fellow at the Open Society Institute, and the founding co-director of Corruption Watch. His book is called The Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade. Welcome, Andrew Feinstein.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
You started to research this book because of an effect you saw on South Africa as a result of the arms trade. What did you observe while you were an MP?
Well, I was very privileged to serve under Nelson Mandela in the first democratic government in South Africa. But as Mandela was retiring, South Africa decided to spend what will ultimately amount to around $10 billion on weapons that the country didn't need and barely uses today. And the reason for that transaction was primarily the $300 million of bribes that were paid on the deal. And in addition to that, which came at huge socioeconomic costs, this was at the time that Mandela's successor, Thabo Mbeki, was saying that we didn't have the fiscal resources to provide life-saving medication to the over 5 million people living with HIV and AIDS. But it was also the point at which the ANC, Mandela's party, started to lose its moral compass. And ironically, some of the people who had played a crucial role in bringing democracy to South Africa were prepared to undermine the very institutions of that democracy that they'd created in order to ensure that the truth about this deal didn't come out into the public domain. And so it made me realize the role that this arms trade plays in the process of governance and politics. And I realized that this wasn't unique to South Africa or even Africa, that this was a global phenomenon.
How were you able to conduct this research?
Well, I was very fortunate. It's a very difficult area to research because a lot of it is kept secret in terms of national security imperatives. But national security is used to hide what is often just quite criminal behavior or very poor policy choices by government. But in my case, because of my experience in South Africa, when I moved to the UK after resigning from Parliament about 10 years ago, investigators, prosecutors, investigative journalists, whistleblowers who were working on the arms trade globally approached me because of my experience in South Africa. And that provided me with a network. It provided me with access to a lot of investigative materials and a lot of archives that hadn't been in the public domain. And this really gave me the basis for the research that went into the book.
In terms of the secret data?
Yes. There was a lot of material. So to give you just one example, I write a lot about a network of illegal or illicit arms dealers that started with a group of former senior Nazi officers in post-war Germany that created a network that has gone on for decades and decades and decades, involved in some of the worst of the illegal arms deals that have been conducted in the post-war period. And I managed to get hold of an archive that was collected in an attempt to try one of these arms dealers, a guy who'd been very involved in Liberia with the then dictator Charles Taylor. This guy was in jail in Italy for almost 5 years. Huge investigations were done around the world. And as so often happens in this trade, which operates in something of a parallel legal universe. Say the laws that apply to you and I somehow don't seem to apply to this industry. And his trial was stopped virtually before it started, with a high court claiming Italy had no jurisdiction over him, which was an astonishingly inept judicial decision. But the chief of police, who'd investigated this guy for many years, allowed an investigator to copy this huge archive of material, and the investigator made it available to me. So I was able to use information that had never been in the public domain. A lot of it was secret. And fortunately, because I work on a principle that I won't use something unless I can confirm its veracity with at least two reliable sources, I haven't, in what is a very tricky legal area, had any legal problems to date.
So the numbers are astounding. The
numbers are terrifying. I mean, first of all, our governments spend about $1.6 trillion a year on defense, with the U.S. spending almost as much as the rest of the world combined. But almost as astonishing is the reality that this trade in weapons accounts for almost 40% of all corruption in all world trade.
You take a little tour throughout the world, and there are some particular companies, such as Lockheed Martin and BAE, that you really focus on. Why don't we start with the United States and with perhaps Lockheed Martin and that relationship, especially with the Bush administration, the Reagan administration, and what has happened since then?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, the U.S. is the dominant player because of how much it spends on national defense and national security. All in all, in terms of national security, in 2010, the U.S. spent around $1 trillion. And because of this position and the amount of weaponry that it produces, primarily through companies like Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, it has a very, very prominent role in the world. I think what is crucial to understand here is that while I tried initially to write two separate narratives, one of the so-called formal trade, the sort of government-to-government trade, which involves the big players, the companies I'm mentioning, and companies like BAE Systems in the United Kingdom, and then I was going to write separately about the illicit trade or the black market in weapons. And the reality is that I discovered that they are so intertwined that it was impossible to write two almost distinct narratives. And the U.S. really encapsulates that, because during the 60s, the 70s, and parts of the 80s, these U.S. companies perhaps paid more bribes, were involved in more corrupt activity than any others in the global arms trade. But then U.S. legislators started toughening up legislation, particularly the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. It was implemented far more stringently. So from the late 80s through the 90s until today, the U.S. is engaged in less overt corruption and bribery in international export deals than, say, a lot of European countries, and certainly than a lot of Chinese or Russian companies. But the thing that stands out for me about the U.S. are really two things. The first is the way in which the domestic weapons procurement system takes place. The way in which these large companies sell incredibly expensive weapon systems to the U.S. military. And what I realized is that this is really a circle of patronage that takes place between the large defense contractors, the Pentagon, where we had, for instance, in 2010, 84% of senior officials in the Pentagon who took retirement in 2010 went into senior executive positions with defense contractors. So in other words, with the companies to whom they had been awarding contracts during their careers in the military. And therefore, a lot of their careers are spent ensuring that their relationships with these companies are extremely good. And then the lawmakers who have to approve these projects in Congress do so because the defense contractors are huge contributors to political campaigns. And of course, they promise jobs in almost every congressional district in the country on the big, most expensive weapons projects. And some of these jobs are really no more than a few people sitting around a table doing nothing in particular, sometimes surfing the internet. But it makes it incredibly difficult for a lawmaker to oppose any of these systems. So this results in situations like we have in the U.S., where the American taxpayer is having to foot the bill for the most expensive jet fighter ever produced, something called the F-35. That will cost a minimum of $382 billion for a jet plane that would have been very useful during the Cold War, but is virtually irrelevant to the sorts of conflict that the U.S. is currently engaged in and, according to U.S. intelligence agencies, is likely to be engaged in for generations to come. And the point that I make is that these sorts of projects simply aren't affordable in the economic environment that the U.S. and the rest of the world finds itself in. So the domestic procurement system itself, I believe, is deeply problematic. And choices are made, like the F-35, that actually undermine national security rather than strengthen it. And then the other thing that really struck me about the U.S. is that a lot of the worst of the illicit or illegal dealers that I investigate and that I expose, for instance, a Lebanese Armenian based in Beirut who has been involved in a lot of the worst arms transactions of the last 40 years, selling into all of the countries that have UN embargoes on them, selling into conflicts that the US, for instance, spends an enormous amount of money trying to resolve. Now, someone like this then turns up in Iraq and Afghanistan as a contractor to the US Department of Defense and to major US defense contractors, and even to USAID in Iraq, Afghanistan, and in the African state of Liberia. And I find this sort of hypocrisy, these sorts of double standards, where the U.S. on the one hand is trying to ensure that its own companies are less engaged in corruption and bribery, but then utilizes at great cost a whole lot of illegal arms dealers who it should actually be bringing to justice, not using for its own war efforts in conflict.
You mentioned this Armenian-Lebanese man, Joe Derhov Sepian.
Correct.
You said that he was involved in some of these most illicit deals. I'd like you to describe some of them first, but also you noted that intelligence agents are engaged in this network, and so they must know. So first of all, let's talk about him and his transactions, and then talk about how it is that people know this, and who knows this, and why you think it continues.
Absolutely. I think the first point is, I mean, I read about this chap in a Commission of Inquiry report, but had never heard of him and could find no record of him. And bizarrely, after over a year of searching for him, I eventually found him on Facebook. And after months and months of pestering him, his first email in response to my communication said, "In my long life, I've never done anything for nothing. Why should I start now?" And I just sent him a stream of emails over a period of months and months, and flattering him and telling him that everyone I spoke to told me he knew more about the trade than anybody else alive. And eventually, out of the blue, I got a call from him, and he said, "Come and meet me in my office in Amman, Jordan, on Sunday," at one of his many offices around the world, and we'll chat. And he outlined to me how he'd started his career with this network of former Nazis, and that's where he'd really got his start in the arms trade. And he, like many modern arms dealers, would sell to both sides in a conflict. He, for instance, they were involved in Egypt when it was still a monarchy. They sold to King Farouk when he was overthrown by General Nasser, who was the ideological opposite of the monarchy. They just continued selling to Nasser. And so it continued. He was very involved in selling to a whole range of sides in the Balkans conflict, even though there was a UN arms embargo on the conflict. He sold extensively into Africa, breaking various arms embargoes there. He traded with apartheid South Africa, and in fact he would sell weapons to the Balkan countries that he would source from apartheid South Africa, which is how he came to be involved in this commission of inquiry. But again, a lot of involvement with American and other intelligence agencies, which is how he stays out of any sort of legal trouble. I found it astounding. You know, he was telling me things that I knew would create legal difficulties for him, and I would say to him, "Are you sure this is on the record?" And he laughed and he said, "Do you think, after a career of over 40 years, that if they wanted me in jail, I'd still be sitting here a free man?" So the reality is that our intelligence agencies use these sorts of people as intelligence assets, sometimes to do deals for them. For instance, this Nazi network was actually established with the help of post-war German intelligence and the CIA, who assisted them in their early deals, which were in the early years of the Cold War, deals that America and Germany couldn't be seen to be doing themselves. So they used these sort of people to do them, and then would continue to use them as intelligence assets over a period of time, even though these people often sell weaponry to America's sworn enemies. But the intelligence relationships continue, and it's something that I find quite extraordinary. And it's why these people are so often protected. And there is the case of the Russian arms dealer, sometimes referred to as the Merchant of Death, although he's one of hundreds, if not thousands, who do similar things, a chap called Victor Boot, who was convicted of gun running that endangered American lives in a New York court. Now, the irony of Victor Boot's situation is that between 2003 and 2005, he made tens of millions of dollars. One estimate put it at $60 million transporting equipment and ammunition and weapons into Baghdad for the United States Department of Defense. And so he was clearly used by the U.S. Department of Defense, intelligence agencies, and government. And then it got to a point where he was no longer useful to them, and he perhaps was selling too much to insurgents and others in those sorts of conflicts. And they decided to arrest him and to try him. So it's a trade that is incredibly deceitful, that is full of hypocrisy. And sadly, our own government, including the government of the United States, is centrally involved in a lot of that hypocrisy and applies the law as and when it suits them.
You mentioned other countries that are also among the largest producers and also acting, as you put it, almost like sales agents for these arms dealers. Russia, France, Germany, Holland, Sweden, Italy, Israel, and China. These are the ones you named.
And the United Kingdom.
And the United Kingdom. Yes. Is it possible to break down the numbers and the regional influence according to these countries?
I think to some extent it is. I mean, if we look at the United States, as I said, the U.S. is by far the most dominant player, accounting for just under 50% of the global trade in weapons. Europe would then come second to that and is fast being caught up by Russia and China. Russia, of course, or the former Soviet Union as it then was also a very big player during the Cold War. Not as big as American intelligence made out, but certainly the second largest player. That situation has dissipated significantly since the demise of the Soviet Union. A lot of the surplus Soviet equipment has been sold off by these illegal or black dealers, often in concert with the governments of the former Soviet states, the Ukraine in particular, which was the sort of weapons factory of the Soviet Union. China is the big growing manufacturer, selling an enormous amount, especially into Africa, into a lot of conflict zones, and I believe creating, intensifying, and perpetuating a lot of those conflicts. So if we look at some of the areas of conflict, the Sudan, the Darfur region, Somalia, where there is such a problem of piracy, there are an enormous amount of Chinese weapons being found in these areas. So the Chinese are the sort of emerging threat. And although in numerical terms, they are not that big a player yet, they are becoming a larger and larger player. So something that I'm certainly looking at going forward. But the second biggest player at the moment is without doubt the European countries. And amongst those, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom dominate. And the government of the United Kingdom in particular, since the time of Margaret Thatcher, has acted really as a salesperson in chief for the UK arms industry and have tacitly condoned what continues to be an enormous amount of bribery and corruption. On the South African deal that we started this conversation with, DAE Systems, the British company, in order to win the largest contract in which there was an massive amount of skullduggery. DAE were not even on the shortlist for this particular contract. The Defense Minister of South Africa insisted they were put on this shortlist. The South African Air Force announced publicly that they would only accept this jet from the British if forced to do so by the politicians, and it cost 2.5 times more than the jet that the Air Force actually wanted. But this British company paid 115 million British pounds in bribes on this one single deal. But this was a tiny percentage of the world's largest arms deal, which was between the UK and Saudi Arabia, something called the Al-Yamamah deal, in which BAE Systems paid 6 billion British pounds in commissions, the vast majority of which were just bribes.
Let me just remind our listeners that we're speaking with Andrew Feinstein, and his book is called The Shadow World: Inside the Global Arms Trade. Before we run out of time, Andrew Feinstein, I'd like to talk a little bit about the effects of this whole system. Every transaction is gray market and black market and above board, and what the effect really is on societies, on democracies, and through its corruption, through its secrecy.
I think that there are multiple effects, the vast majority of which are negative. You know, in over 11 years now of working on this area, I have yet to come across a substantial arms deal that isn't in some way tainted by illegality of one sort or another. And the corruption, the bribery, the making of inappropriate decisions, decisions that are not in the best interest of the countries buying the equipment, do undermine the very nature of our democratic system, the very way in which we are governed. We see enormous amounts of money being wasted on inappropriate weapons choices, no more so than in the United States today. We see the attempt to cover up the illegality or the poor decision making leads to further undermining of our democratic institutions, sometimes the very rule of law. And the other very close relationship that I think is incredibly harmful to the way in which we are ruled is that the relationships between these companies and our governments are so close, are not open to the scrutiny of a normal industry, and nor are these industries regulated in anything like the way those industries that are regarded as harmful to our health, be it tobacco, alcohol, drugs, these are highly regulated industries. I would argue that the defense industry, which is involved in so much conflict and the loss of so much life, is also a danger to our health, but it's far less regulated than many of these other industries. So in these myriad ways, it not only intensifies and perpetuates conflict around the world, and also therefore informs the way in which we make foreign policy choices, which I would argue in the United States since the Reagan era, through all of the presidents since then, has favored the use of force rather than diplomatic means to resolve diplomatic disputes or issues. But they also ensure that there is a whole component of the way in which we are governed, that we as taxpayers, as voters, don't have full access to. And I think that that is also extremely harmful. But then, of course, the primary harm is in the numbers of conflicts that we're engaged in and the human suffering, both of our own citizens and people and those of other nations, that are a consequence of those conflicts.
You noted that President Carter had been the president that reduced this kind of expenditure more than any other president since 1951. But when we look now, what would be the motivation of leaders like the ones in Great Britain, democratic leaders in European countries or wherever, to perpetuate such a system besides campaign contributions?
I think there's a political imperative in the sense that these companies do disperse significant amounts of money to political parties, to political candidates around the world. So I think that is a very important incentive. I think the second incentive relates to issues of national security, that no political leader wants to be seen as weak on national security, especially post the 9/11 tragedy, for obvious reasons. Then I think there is also what they see as the economic benefits, although I think those are often exaggerated. I think that they are not open to sufficient scrutiny. And those benefits, if the same amount of public money that is invested into the defense sector was invested into other manufacturing sectors, we could produce between 3 and 7 times more jobs for every dollar invested than is created in the defense sector and other sectors. But I think that because the industry is so powerful politically, that political leaders don't want to risk alienating the industry. And I think this has been a big problem. You know, if we look at the case of President Obama, when he was a candidate, he spoke about changing the procurement system, taking on the defense contractors. And one of the first things he did when he was in office, he introduced some new ethical guidelines to try and close down the revolving door, the movement of people between government, the defense establishment, the intelligence establishment, and the defense contractors. Within a matter of months of introducing those new ethical guidelines, his own administration violated them with a very major appointment of somebody who had been a lobbyist for Lockheed Martin for 25 years. And I think it was at that point that Obama, now as a new president, realized that he simply did not have the political capital to take on this incredibly powerful nexus of interest between the contractors, the military establishment, and lawmakers, and that he decided that this wasn't an issue that he was going to take on. Although I would argue that in terms of the United States fiscal position, one of the most important things would be, not in a radical way, but to reduce the levels of defense spending and ensure that the United States got far greater value for money in the defense dollars that it does spend. Because if we look just at the last 5 years, defense contractors have overspent on contracts awarded to them by almost $300 billion. Almost all of the equipment is delivered years, sometimes decades late. So there is a basic value for money question. But I think that President Obama felt that he simply does not have the political capital to take on what Eisenhower described as the military-industrial complex.
Finally, before we let you go, do you see any potential solutions?
Often researching and writing and campaigning on this area feels a little like banging my head against a brick wall. But the one thing that does give me hope at the moment is more people are starting to talk about this. The fact that my book is out there. This is the first book that has been published on the global arms trade in over 2 decades for a variety of reasons. And I think the reality that many ordinary taxpayers, many ordinary voters are asking themselves whether their governments, whether their political processes are actually working for them at the moment. So when they're asking whether they're getting value for money from their government, which is so necessary in economic times like our own, I think more and more people are starting to question the wisdom of the amounts of money that we are spending on these sorts of issues and the sorts of value that we are getting for this. And it would only require some quite small but very significant changes to be able to create an arms trade that is more transparent, more honest, and that actually contributes more meaningfully to our real national security rather than undermining that national security in the pursuit of profits and influence.
Well, that's a perfect place to end for now until we do part two. Andrew Feinstein is the author of The Shadow World Inside the Global Arms Trade. I cannot recommend the book enough. It is one of the most profound things I've read in a very, very long time. Thank you so much, Andrew Feinstein.
Thank you for having me on.
When we come back, what is the reality with regards to issues of poverty, inequality, and social mobility, both in the U.S. and abroad? How did we get here? What is driving the gaps here and worldwide? Stay tuned.
Rich man's got his picture on the cover of a magazine. There's a pampered life with a trophy wife and his long black limousines. He's got all the money in the whole wide world and toys he'll never use. But he don't know a damn thing about when a poor man gets the blues. Rich man thinks his shoes are made to walk wherever he wants. From the top of all them high-rise buildings to the bottom of the honky-tonks. He'll step on everything in between, but he won't walk a mile in my shoes. And he don't know a damn thing about when a poor man gets the blues.
Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. What is the reality with regards to issues of poverty, inequality, and social mobility, both in the U.S. and abroad? How did we get here? What is driving the gaps here and worldwide? We have with us three experts. Lane Kenworthy is professor of sociology and political science at the University of Arizona. He is author of Progress for the Poor, Jobs with Equality, and Egalitarian Capitalism. David Smith also joins us. He is professor of sociology at the University of California, Irvine. He is author of Third World Cities in Global Perspective, A New World Order, Global Transformations in Late 20th Century, and Labor versus Empire. Gregory Clark is professor and chair of the Department of Economics at the University of California, Davis. His books include A Farewell to Alms, ALMS, A Brief Economic History of the World. Thank you so much for being with us. I'd like to start with Professor Clark. In your book, Farewell to Arms, you attempted to look back all the way to egalitarian society of hunters and gatherers to understand how inequality developed both within nations and between nations, a big part of which you said was technology. Give us the short history of inequality and what you call the great divergence.
The good news within societies is that going back to when we can first really measure inequality well, back in the Middle Ages, the tendency has been for inequality to decline until very recent times within societies such as England or Germany. But between societies, what has actually dramatically happened since the Industrial Revolution has been much greater inequality. And so the net effect at the world scale has actually been a tendency towards growing inequality. But as I say, composed of these very different elements, what's happening within societies, and what you find even going back to medieval England is just enormous levels of inequality. And the Industrial Revolution actually represented a move towards much greater equality because wages became much more important as a source of income. But I'd say between societies, there's much greater inequality. And so how we feel about it globally is going to depend how we feel about inequality within societies as opposed to between societies.
David Smith?
Sociologists who look at global inequalities find kind of mixed things. On the one hand, they find that very recently, there's been some decline in between-nation inequalities, actually. But what we're seeing is rising inequality within nations and also across the entire spectrum of the world, particularly in the last two or three decades with the rise of neoliberal capitalist economies and the focus on the new international division of labor as manufacturing has moved from the advanced core countries into other parts of the world. There actually has been some push towards polarization, also the whole process of financialization in places like the largest global cities, a great deal of inequality, partly because those people that are involved in financial services, the one percenters, if you will, demand a lot of service workers, so that there is a rise of demand for service workers, but those are usually very poorly paid people, domestic workers, gardeners, people like that, and a lot of times that's, in the United States at least, and actually in other societies as well, often undocumented migrants are doing that kind of stuff. So actually we've seen, at least in the last just fairly recent period, in the last two or three decades, a pretty dramatic rise in inequality. And it's also been pushed along by political forces as well that have to do with tax structures and things like that.
So it sounds like what we're saying is we went from egalitarian to less egalitarian to more egalitarian to then again less egalitarian.
David Smith again. I think right now we're seeing a push towards more inegalitarian, but there is a tendency, you know, sort of a Carl Polanyi talks about this idea that things do tend to sweep back and forth, and social movements oftentimes push back against these extreme levels of inequality, and I think that might be what we're seeing with things like the Occupy movement. I don't know how efficacious that'll be, but that is a push against this by civil society, I think, by people.
Lane Kenworthy.
I studied mostly the rich countries of the world, say the 20 or so richest. And in those, I think you can see, in some ways, a similar development to what's been described for the world as a whole. So in the period since more or less the 1970s, within many of these nations, we do see an increase in income inequality. And yet between these nations, and again, I'm just talking about the 20 richest or so, we see a reduction in inequality in the sense that the economies of those who started at the bottom, and those are countries like Ireland and Spain and Portugal, for most of this period, now Ireland's had a setback with the crash and Spain and Portugal to some degree too, but up until 2008 in any case, those countries were growing more rapidly than those at the top like the United States. And so we saw a bit of decline on average between countries, and yet in most, not all, but most, there was a rise in income inequality within the nations, between people within these countries.
Gregory Clark, let's bring you back in.
One problem in dealing with inequality is that there's always a demand for kind of an instant diagnosis of what's happening over the last 2 or 3 or 10 years. And there's always a worry about how much we can really project trends forward. A lot of the inequality rise in America is very closely connected with the financial services industry. And we don't know really, is that just a disequilibrium that will eventually get corrected by a flood of people into this industry and an increase of competition in the industry, or does it represent some kind of long-run trend? At the same time, there was some talk about service workers. Well, one of the huge service sectors that's rising in all these advanced countries now is medicine. And medicine as a sector is composed of both very high-paid workers and a lot of low-paid workers. And again, it's very hard to project what the balance of employment in growing sectors like medicine is going to be in the future. So it's much easier to say what the trends have been, what they've been in the past, but in any sense to say, are we really at a juncture in history where a long-run trend towards equality came to a screeching halt, and we're now headed towards much more unequal societies? That's just very difficult to tell.
There have been some political scientists who have analyzed the United States in particular, not so much the global perspective that the three of you have all looked at, and found that really it's not so much necessarily just an economic problem, but this is a political problem. And it's partly the assertion of the, David Smith, you referred to the 1%, or really the large corporate executives and their lobbyists, to change the laws in their favor. If we were going to back up and take a look at the causes, especially in the last few decades, because this has really changed since the late 70s, what would we attribute the various rises in inequality to politically? Can we look at those policies?
And this is David Smith. I think there's two causes of why poverty is rising in the United States and economic insecurity. And one is government policies. And you can talk about Reagan and Bush and Clinton and Bush. I mean, it's both Democrats and Republicans and their attack against big government in the United States. Their eagerness to cut the welfare state, to lower taxes in general, and particularly lower taxes to the highest income people, to get poor people off public assistance, massive federal and state budget cuts for things like food stamps and welfare and job training, or aid to urban and rural poverty in various parts of the country, ending welfare as we know it in 1996, and that was, again, pushed by Newt Gingrich, you know, when he was the Speaker of the House, but it was eagerly signed by President Clinton, so you got both parties involved in that. There's a sort of a longer term, but then also, as you said, there's the kind of argument that Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson make in The Winner Take All Politics, which is that there's been a very explicit attempt by conservative groups in the past probably 20 years to push for changes in the tax code. And then, of course, on the other hand, there's the second group, which is all these big economic changes. The shift of the new international division of labor with manufacturing moving offshore, capital flight, the decimation of labor unions in the United States, which is partly political, and this massive sectoral shift, which is this growth in tertiary or service work. And I think that my colleague is right, that it's hard to predict how that's going to turn out, because service work includes very high-skilled people in the legal or medical profession who get paid a lot, but also a lot of low-income people. So you have to look at both the economic forces and the political forces.
At some point, we want to go back also into the more cultural forces that, Gregory Clark, you talked about a little bit in your book, A Farewell to Alms, as well. Before we do, I wanted to bring Lane Kenworthy back in. You actually asked the question of whether social welfare policies reduce poverty, and you looked across countries. What is your comparative find?
I don't think there's too much question that they do. You can ask this question in various ways and look at various aspects of it. But generally speaking, it's pretty clear that both transfers and to some extent services, although services usually don't show up in the kinds of income measures that we use in calculating inequality and poverty. But both of these things do tend to help those on the bottom of the income distribution and thereby reduce both poverty and income inequality. And I guess this might be a good place to just point out to listeners that at least in the rich countries, when we're talking about a rise in inequality, there really are two components to this, and you can see it, especially in a nation like the United States, where income inequality has really shot through the roof in the last several decades. So one is a widening of incomes, let's say, roughly speaking, within the bottom 99% or maybe 95%, depending on where you want to draw the line. And that's been going on since the 1970s. And then the other component of it, which is probably better known to most everyone, at least in the last several months, is the widening of the gap between those at the top of the distribution, let's call them the 1%, and then the rest. And both of those things have been going up, although I should say that in the last 15 years or so, since roughly the mid-1990s, the story of widening inequality in the United States is mainly one of the latter, of the top 1% pulling away from everybody else and less a widening within the bottom 99%. That happened a lot in the 80s and the early part of the 1990s.
I'd like to bring Gregory Clark back in. You look at this across, what, I think you said 32 generations. It was just an enormous look back, and what may have happened early on may not be as appropriate to look at today in the latest few decades. But you also thought that there was this aspect of cultural, even a kind of genetic component. How do you bring those in?
My latest project has been looking at social mobility, and over a very long run, going back to England in the Middle Ages. And one thing that actually shows up using the new measures that I have is that social mobility is dramatically lower than is typically estimated, both for current societies and for earlier societies, and that there really is very strong persistence of the upper income groups, the elite groups, and that it does raise this possibility that there really are these kind of cultural elements to economic success that are persistent over a very long period. And one way that shows up is that some of the most unequal societies in the world are those where you get a mixture of groups that come from very different historical kind of cultural backgrounds, such as when you have Chinese populations in Southeast Asia, when you have Chinese populations in Latin America. There's evidence that when you do have this kind of mixing of groups with these very different backgrounds, that's a recipe for a lot of inequality, and it suggests that there is some kind of strong cultural transmission of economic success.
You noted that the gypsies, for example, and the travelers have really historically not been able to rise in economic scale, whereas other ethnic groups, I think you noted the Jewish community, have really been able to transcend over time considerably.
Yes, the research that I'm doing on mobility actually uses people's surnames as a way of measuring mobility. And what should happen in a mobile society is that all common surnames should end up with the same average status. And then surnames like Smith and Clark and Kenworthy. What you actually find is that even in societies we think of as very egalitarian, such as Sweden, if I can find someone with a rare surname who went to university in Sweden in 1700, that person is still five times more likely to be at university now in Sweden, that name, than a name like Anderson. And you really get surprising levels of persistence of particular groups. And I'd say a puzzle about this is, well, how do these groups continue to persist, as such as, for example, the gypsy population or the traveler population in England, which has remained at the bottom of the social ladder for 300 or 400 years. But I actually think that the way that typically happens is that that group is redefined every generation by people leaving the group and assimilating to the general population, and then others actually integrating into the group. That it's not actually the continuation of the descendants of such groups. It's actually selective recruitment that's going on. But I would say that this issue about mobility is important because how we feel about inequality in modern societies is going to be very closely connected to how we feel about mobility.
Lane Kenworthy, this is also one of your areas, mobility.
I'd like to make a slightly related point, which is that it's very useful to keep two different aspects of inequality separate. So one question is, how much inequality is there within a country, let's say, and how is that changing over time? We often use the metaphor of a ladder to help people think about this. So here we're talking about how high the ladder is, how far apart the rungs are. And then another question is, where do particular people or particular groups of people, let's say, fall within that distribution of earnings and income? So that's the question of where are certain people on the ladder. And you can have a society in which the separation between the rungs on the ladder is rising at the same time that the distinction between different groups of people is somewhat declining. And I think in some respects that characterizes the United States over the last generation or so. So, for example, inequality between women and men has diminished pretty markedly, especially if we're talking about earnings and income, but in other respects as well. And in some respects, that's true for African Americans and whites, although not in all respects. So in some ways, we've been becoming a less unequal society. If your interest is in the places where particular groups of people end up on the rungs, and yet, in the other respect, how far apart the rungs are, you know, what's the difference between someone at the top and someone in the middle and someone at the bottom, there we become a much more unequal society.
David Smith?
I think those points are all well taken. I do think that a lot of sociologists get very nervous when we start hearing about cultural factors that define mobility and inequality and poverty. There's sort of a long tradition of an argument about a culture of poverty for certain groups, and it tends to be ascribed to, say, African Americans or Latino Americans, the idea that some language is the language of the ghetto. We've heard that by politicians. And the idea somehow or other is that there's something cultural that's holding people back. That there's a big analysis in the 1960s and 70s, including Senator Moynihan, also a sociologist, who had kind of an analysis of how culture in the urban areas was holding people back and creating poverty. And I think that the danger in this is that there may be some important cultural factors, importance to education and things like that, but the danger is that there's a tendency to blame the victims. Oh, well, those other people, not us, but those people are held back by the fact that they don't value work the same or they don't have the same time consciousness. I think a lot of people get very nervous about sort of cultural explanations because of that history, at least, and the way that that's been used. The other thing is I think neoliberalism today and the push to cut all kinds of government services and welfare services may be pushing us towards a society where disadvantaged minorities who are disadvantaged by discrimination about a lot of other factors, where they live, the kind of schools that their children go to, they may be particularly and differentially disadvantaged by government cuts and neoliberal policies. And then there's a tendency for people to, at least in the general population, say, oh, well, that's because they're from those culturally defined groups. And I cringe a little bit when I hear these kinds of cultural arguments.
Let me ask you a cultural question in a different frame, and that is, one thing that perplexes me is the United States culture, if we could say there is kind of a big general culture, tends to reward people who are extraordinarily wealthy by pushing money. You were talking about the financialization, by investment, but not by hard work per se. So what we end up doing is rewarding those people in the millions and billions who move money around in all these various ways, whereas people who actually work two jobs, sometimes three jobs, are their wages we've seen stagnate or even in some cases decline. And this is partly a question that I've wrestled with in terms of culture.
I think you're right. I'm not sure it's just American culture. Maybe it's that American culture is diffused to the rest of the world. In a way, it's the culture of, for lack of a better expression, capitalism that kind of has rewarded the winners and really not rewarded the people who are not able to distinguish themselves. You know, it even happens in academia where the big name people, it's a winner-take-all system.
Gregory Clark?
As an economist, I feel I have to stand up for capitalism. And I just want to say that the U.S. has very monetized system of rewards. But the interesting thing is that if you go to societies like Sweden, who I think most sociologists would think of as a more open, a better structured society, it's as immobile currently as the United States is. If we measure it by things like who are the doctors in Sweden and how much can we trace their elite position to their ancestors 300 years ago, there's this much immobility in a society like Sweden where doctors are not paid as much more the median worker as in Sweden as in the United States, but it's still the case that access to that elite is very much predictable from inheritance within Sweden. And what I find in this study is that to a surprising degree, it's very difficult for societies to change the rate of social mobility, and that mass education, redistribution in countries like Sweden, much narrower inequalities of income and wealth are actually not particularly associated with any great increase in mobility within the societies.
that sounds like a place for Lane Kenworthy to come in.
Well, I haven't seen Gregory Clark's recent research, so I'm not sure how, if at all, to respond to it. It may well be right, for all I know, but I will say that among those, mainly economists, some sociologists, and a few other social scientists who these days study what we call intergenerational mobility, which is what he's referring to. So it, roughly speaking, it's what are your odds of ending up in a different place in the earnings or income distribution than your parents? The data for the most recent generation suggests a much higher degree of intergenerational mobility in countries like Sweden and Denmark, Norway and Finland, than in a country like the United States, or let's say the United Kingdom. It happens that those Nordic countries have much less income inequality as well, and some people have argued recently that there's a causal link between the two. That is to say, less income inequality ends up translating into or causes a higher degree of intergenerational mobility. I'm not certain that that's the case, but for the countries for which we have pretty trustworthy data, there is a fairly strong statistical correlation between the two things, with higher inequality countries tending to have lower mobility. Again, this is just for the most recent generation, so I have no idea if it holds over the long stretch of time, but that's what we see in the data at the moment.
Right, Clark, again, I absolutely agree with Lane that it's unfair to cite stuff that you won't have any opportunity to see. But that's what I was interested in, is that these measures of mobility clearly suggest that Scandinavia is much more mobile than the United States. And they also clearly suggest that in a country like Scandinavia, in two generations, you would have almost complete social mobility. And I think one of the problems is that in a society like Sweden, where there's much less differential in incomes, so that someone who's a veterinary surgeon, for example, earns not that much more than someone who's a bus driver, it becomes very hard to measure social mobility using such things as income, because there's just a lot of errors components in those measurements, and that it leads us to a false sense of the immobility of modern U.S. society. So I think there are a lot of problems with the modern United States, but that once we switch to measures like looking at the frequency of names, the information content of names, other things like that, we actually see that the U.S. can be criticized on many grounds, but it turns out that it has not become, in my view at least, an immobile society compared to societies like Scandinavia.
In our last few minutes, turn it back to the U.S. When we look at the U.S. Census, we know that we've got something like 15% of Americans classified as poor, something like one in seven people, maybe more now. Given each of your backgrounds into the kind of causes of these things, where you think we could go if we wanted to fix this problem? David Smith, I'd like to start with you.
It seems to me that the two parties, despite the fact that the Democrats are seen, you know, and demonized as socialists, are actually pretty similar when it comes to a lot of these issues. And frankly, I think a lot of people on the left are very, very disappointed with President Obama in terms of taking on some of these big corporate interests. So my own feeling, I guess, really the best hope is some kind of mobilization by people like the Occupy movement that really raises consciousness, changes the discourse and the debates about what's important, and really kind of sort of shines a light on a lot of these issues about financialization, polarization, some of the things that we've been talking about.
Gregory Clark, I'm going to sandwich you in between the two sociologists.
I think there's been some interest amongst economists in taxing much more heavily financial transactions on the grounds there actually has been a feeling that the best minds of the generation have been pulled into a sector of the economy which is basically making money through market failures and imperfections in the market. So I think a lot of economists would actually be quite sympathetic to the idea of significant amounts of redistribution of that 1%. The one fear, though, is that those financial services industries will just move offshore, and that countries like Britain will simply capture those rents if the United States doesn't. But I think there is some sense amongst economists that more redistribution would be entirely appropriate and actually beneficial to the economy as opposed to hurtful.
Lane Kenworthy.
My sense is that this debate about the degree to which we should worry about the rise in income inequality and about fairness in American politics recently, or at the current moment, has played out largely with respect to the question of whether and how much we should increase taxes on those at the very top. And I think that's fine and important. Personally, I would favor doing that. I think there's plenty of evidence that not only can the rich afford it, their incomes have gone up quite a lot, but in prior moments in history when tax rates were higher, the economy did just fine, so there'd be little, if any, cost in terms of economic growth and so on. At the same time, I wish the debate were wider. That is to say, I wish it were focused not only on taxes at the top, but also on other things that might both reduce inequality and, to go back to the mobility question, maybe improve mobility and opportunity and reduce poverty. And I'll just mention one here. I think one of the best things that we could do going forward as a society is dramatically expand our funding for early education, child care, and good quality educational preschools. One story that can be told about the Nordic countries, Sweden, Denmark, Finland, and Norway in the last generation, is that this is the most important change that they've made in their set of social policies. And rather than the fact that they have low income inequality, or maybe in addition to it, that this is a big part of the reason why they seem to have pretty high rates of intergenerational mobility, pretty high amount of opportunity for people who grow up in lower-income households to escape that and move into the middle and upper part of the distribution. I don't think we know for sure that that's right, but I think the evidence is accumulating that that's a very good use of societal resources. And so I really hope and wish that our debate will get extended in that direction and not focus solely on taxes.
Thank you to the three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. I enjoyed it.
Lane Kenworthy is professor of sociology and political science at the University of Arizona. He is author of Progress for the Poor, Jobs with Equality, and Egalitarian Capitalism. David Smith is professor of sociology at the University of California, Irvine. He is author of Third World Cities in Global Perspective, A New World Order, Global Transformations in Late 20th Century, and Labor versus Empire. Gregory Clark is professor and chair of the Department of Economics at the University of California, Davis. His books include A Farewell to Alms, ALMS, A Brief Economic History of the World. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.